We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson's our producer. Jason Croft is at the controls. We're happy to have in this hour of the show as our guest Peter Bergen. He is CNN's national security analyst. He's authored a number of books about U.S. policy and the war on terror, including Holy War Incorporated and the Osama bin Laden I Know. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and New York University's Center on Law and Security. He's written for a number of publications, New York Times, Washington Post, The Atlantic, Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs. He is the author of a newly published book that we'll be talking about today, The Longest War. The subtitle is The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda, and it is published by the Free Press. He makes the point that we have heard a great deal about what the United States has done to combat terrorism since 9/11, but really very little about what America's opponents have been doing and thinking, and that is something that he tries to address in the book, as he looks at a number of very big questions, including the potential threat posed by Al-Qaeda, why it is that its leader, Osama bin Laden, is still at large, and also the question of how much longer and to what extent the United States will have troops in Afghanistan. So we'll try and touch on all of these things this morning. And of course, as always, questions are welcome. We do hope that people who call in will be on target with the topic. We'll try to be brief so we can get in as many callers as possible, but your questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You also can email your question, if you like, to will-talk@illinois.edu. Also, we want to say thanks to the engineer Mike Jones at the New America Foundation for providing this high-quality connection with our guest, Peter Bergen. And Mr. Bergen, hello.
Thank you, David.
Well,
how are you?
I'm fine. And yourself?
Good.
Thanks for being with us. I think that probably for a lot of people, they think about the beginning of our conflict with Al-Qaeda being 9/11. Some people might think back a little earlier to the attack on the Kohl, but maybe before we talk about 9/11, you might talk a little bit about the deeper roots of the assault on the United States by Al-Qaeda and how far back this goes.
Wow. I mean, it could go back as far as bin Laden's teenage years when he began to be politicized. He was a very religious teenager. He was praying seven times a day, twice more than was required by by Islam. He was fasting twice a week, and he was becoming very politicized on the issue of Palestine. This is according to his friends, some of whom I interviewed for the book. This is according to his mother, who is on the record about this issue. And, you know, so from an early age, he was sort of anti-American. This anti-Americanism hardened into pathological hatred of the United States as a result of Operation Desert Shield, which became Operation Desert Storm, the U.S. effort to get Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait in 1990-1991. Bin Laden saw the presence of American soldiers in the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia as sort of infidels, quote-unquote, trespassing in the Saudi Holy Land. And from then on, he began a campaign against the United States. It wasn't really well understood in the early 90s that Al-Qaeda was already trying to attack American targets in Yemen, probably had some role in the Mogadishu attacks in 93. And it only really became really apparent to observers like myself and others in 1997 when he went on CNN, an interview I produced, and declared war on the United States, that this guy was at least serious in intent. And then his capabilities became clear in 98 when Al-Qaeda blew up almost simultaneously two U.S. embassies in Africa, killing more than 200 people.
Mm. There has been a great deal of criticism of the Bush administration for failing to anticipate and perhaps to prevent the attack of 9/11. I think that also there would be some criticism due to the Clinton administration for also not recognizing there was a threat. Do you think, though, that both administrations should have indeed, that Osama bin Laden should have been very high on their list of potential threats?
Yeah. Well, you know, the 9/11 Commission was a bipartisan commission, and it focused on institutional failures at the CIA and FBI, which, fair enough, there were failures. But it sort of skirted the question of what the responsibility of the Clinton or the Bush administrations were, because they were trying to put out a report that had bipartisan support. My view, and I explain this in detail in the book, is I think the Clinton administration did a pretty reasonable job of understanding al-Qaeda was a threat after all. Two U.S. embassies blew up on their watch. Bin Laden was obviously responsible. They took the threat pretty seriously. I don't think the Bush administration took the threat nearly seriously enough. Of the 33 principal meetings which means cabinet-level meetings that the Bush administration had before 9/11, only one was about al-Qaeda and terrorism. Almost immediately coming into office, they had a cabinet-level meeting about the supposedly pressing issue of Iraq, which shows you where their head was. This was a group of people who had come out of the Cold War. The entire rise of al-Qaeda happened when they were out of office, and they just discounted it. And this, you know, there's a philosophical distinction between belief and knowledge. Sometimes you can kind of know things without believing them, and they were certainly informed multiple times by George Tenet and others in the CIA that there was a big problem. But President Bush took the longest vacation in presidential history in the summer of 2001. It was the longest presidential vacation for 3 decades. Despite the fact that he was getting all this pretty alarming intelligence. Condoleezza Rice testified before the 9/11 Commission that the administration was at battle stations before 9/11, yet there's absolutely no historical evidence to show that. The only people who were really concerned were people in the CIA, the very small counterterrorism group in the National Security Council, and elements of the FBI. But, you know, the top levels of the Bush administration just did not see this as a threat because they were preoccupied by state-based threats, which they understood, Iraq, China. They were preoccupied by anti-ballistic missile defense, which, of course, A, doesn't work, and B, wouldn't stop terrorists even if it did.
Mm. Well, you and others have certainly written about these failures of vision. Certainly much has been written about the Bush administration decision to invade Iraq and the fact that really hadn't, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, and certainly the two, bin Laden and Saddam Hussein and his regimes, were antithetical to one another. So a good deal has been written about this, and then mistakes that were made after the military victory was achieved in Iraq. Having said all that, why is it that really no one has been held accountable for all of those bad decisions that were made?
Well, I think historians are going to, and I don't position myself as a historian, I'm more of a journalist, but I mean, I've tried to write a history of all this, and I think historians are going to hold people accountable. I think it's the nature of American society that responsibility is not taken by people in political office. I think in other cultures, there might have been a resignation or two after 9/11. After all, it was the gravest national security kind of blow in American history. In Japan, somebody might have gone out and committed harikari. I'm not suggesting that would have been the right approach. Or in China, somebody might have been executed. I mean, cultures treat failures in different ways. Now, 45 years, you know, during World War II, Admiral Kimmel, who was the admiral and who was responsible at Pearl Harbor, he was forced out of office very quickly. And he was forced to resign as a result of the Pearl Harbor incident. And I think that, it says something about the changing mores of American political culture that no one in the Bush administration ever apologized, took responsibility, or was in any way, sanctioned for these events. The first Bush administration official to take some form of public position on this in the form of an apology was Dick Clark, the counterterrorism coordinator, who famously testified before the 9/11 Commission and turned to the 9/11 families who were there and said, your government failed you and I failed you. And that's just a fact. But, of course, Richard Clark was one of the people who was actually ringing the alarm. He was one of the people who was actually doing the right thing.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Peter Bergen. He is CNN's national security analyst, and we're talking about his new book, The Longest War. The subtitle is The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. It's published by the Free Press. We have a caller here. We'd welcome others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller. We'll bring them into the conversation. Someone in Piatone. This is line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, David and Peter. Nice conversation got here. You know, I agree with you a lot, Peter, with all this that's out there. Now, you being in the media, don't you think there's a little bit of biasness out there as far as, you know, some of the security stuff? Because it seems to me now that the left is in there, the left seems to want to handle, you know, hammer the right. The WikiLeaks thing, you know, it keeps coming up. And I honestly, to be honest, with somebody like Julian Assange, this guy could be a hindrance to us. I do not agree with what the Bush administration did by going in Iraq. I think what they did is to kind of close out the storybook as far as Dad was concerned. But I think a lot of it was misinformation from other countries. I think our guys let the ball drop, wasn't relying on our own intelligence or lack thereof. And I think that's the problem to this day. I think, you know, they'd rather screen people and make them go through X-ray machines instead of following up on, you know, what I would call a serious problem. And I think south of the border is going to be a big, big problem if it ever happens again. Because, and by the way, that's where a lot of these terrorists came from, too. I don't know if you did that research. That's what I come up with. But I'd like to hear your comments on that, and I'll get off. Thank you, sir. Good day, and have a good day.
Okay.
There's absolutely no evidence at all that any terrorists have ever come through the southern border of this country.
Let's return to the subject of what it is that the kind of information that the Bush administration had. And I think that some people are saying, well, they did the best they could with the information that was available. There are other people who make the argument that says, well, that they actually they had the end conclusion in mind, and as they went along, they just picked up bits of information that would support what it is that they wanted to do, and which was to go into Iraq. So was this bad intelligence, or was this a kind of a willful cherry-picking of intelligence?
You know, in the book, I don't get into the whole weapons of mass destruction discussion because it's been so well covered elsewhere. But what I do get into is this whole question of the extent to which Saddam and al-Qaeda were allied. Because 6 months into the Iraq War, 70% of Americans thought that Saddam Hussein was personally involved in 9/11, which is astonishing because the largest criminal investigation in history was simultaneously showing that Saddam had nothing to do with this. And so then you ask yourself, well, why is it that Americans were so had this implausible idea? Well, because they were being fed a constant diet by the Bush administration that Saddam and al-Qaeda were allied at the hip. Donald Rumsfeld said there was bulletproof evidence showing that al-Qaeda and Saddam were in bed together. Why is this important? Because even if you took the most threatening case for Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction program, which we now know retrospectively didn't really exist, but even if you accepted the most threatening case, Saddam didn't have ballistic missile systems capable of reaching the United States. So you had to say that he was a threat because he was allied to terrorists. He might give weapons of mass destruction to terrorists. You had to have this chain of logic. And so this alliance between Saddam and al-Qaeda, this supposed alliance, was something that the Bush administration repeatedly harped on. And in fact, there was no evidence at the time that this was true. The one piece of evidence that sort of supposedly proved this connection, which Secretary Powell used in his now infamous speech to the United Nations, was garnered from a coercive interrogation of somebody in al-Qaeda who was put in an Egyptian prison, and to basically make sure that he got tortured less, gave up information indicating Saddam and al-Qaeda were allied. And in fact, that there's just nothing to this. And in fact, every investigation since has shown there was nothing to it. And at the time, I was writing that it didn't make any sense that Zarqawi, the al-Qaeda guy in Iraq, had some links to Saddam. Anybody who knew much about it just knew that this, on the face of it, didn't make any sense.
Hmm. It certainly has been quite a lot written about the United States and the Bush administration and its response to 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq and our presence in Afghanistan and so forth. What I think that you have done here that really hasn't been done quite as much is to try to shed some light on the motivations of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, starting with the question of what is it that bin Laden hoped to accomplish by the attacks of 9/11? What was it that he thought would be the result?
Yeah, bin Laden, laid out in a series of interviews before 9/11 that he thought the United States was a paper tiger, similar to the Soviet Union. He based that analysis on our pullouts from Somalia, Vietnam, and Beirut in the 80s. And he naively felt that if he attacked the United States would pull out of the Middle East, and the authoritarian regimes, for instance, the Mubarak regime or the Saudi royal family, would fall. Well, quite the opposite happened. The United States didn't pull out of the Middle East after it was attacked on 9/11. We occupied Afghanistan, which we continue to occupy. We then invaded Iraq. And our relationship with regimes like Mubarak and the Saudi royal family became closer than ever, based on our shared goal of making sure that radical Islamists like bin Laden and his ilk don't get anywhere in the Middle East. Now, what's happening right now in Egypt, of course, is what bin Laden hoped would happen, which is a revolution against the Mubarak regime, but it's not being led in any form by bin Laden, ideologically or tactically or in any way. Instead, it's being led by a coalition of people in Egypt who are just fed up with Mubarak. Mm-hmm. And they range on one side from secular liberals like Ayman Nour to the Muslim Brotherhood to, just anybody in the street. And so there are popular revolutions that are going on in the Middle East, but it's got nothing to do with al-Qaeda. And I'm sure we'll hear from Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two in al-Qaeda, who is himself an Egyptian. And I'm sure we'll hear from bin Laden. They'll try and take some form of credit or applaud some of the action that's going on. But in fact, they're very marginal to what's going on in the Middle East right now.
Before the 9/11 attack, when it was in the planning stage, did all of the leadership, was all of the leadership of al-Qaeda behind this?
No, not at all. And in fact, I interviewed somebody for the book who is a leader of a Libyan Islamic fighting group, which is trying to overthrow the Gaddafi regime, and a very smart guy called Noman Ben Okman. He went to Afghanistan for a sort of summit meeting of jihadi groups from around the region in the summer of 2000 and essentially told bin Laden that attacking the United States, which was clearly part of the plan, was a very bad idea because it would limit the ability of the jihadi groups to overthrow the authoritarian regimes they're hoping to overthrow. And even within al-Qaeda's senior leadership, there were misgivings about the attack, either because it was perhaps un-Islamic to attack civilians going to work on a Tuesday morning, or because it might just be tactically not the right thing to do. So what appeared to be this enormous victory on 9/11 for al-Qaeda, I argue, was actually a strategic defeat for the group because al-Qaeda means the base in Arabic, and they lost their base in Afghanistan. They ran something of a parallel state in Afghanistan. They've never recovered anything of that. They have, to some degree, migrated into the tribal areas of Pakistan, but they don't have an entire country at their disposal. The scale of what al-Qaeda had in Afghanistan has never been replicated because we put a huge amount of pressure on them since.
Well, what did that mean that the response of the United States to 9/11, the invasion of Afghanistan, the toppling of the Taliban, the denial now of al-Qaeda and other kinds of groups of their base of operation and the kind of pressure that the United States has put on al-Qaeda, what did that all mean for Osama bin Laden and his leadership of the organization?
Well, because bin Laden leads his organization as a charismatic leader with whom you cannot basically, it's bin Laden's way or the highway. And so he, he could have said after the fall of the Taliban, look to his folks, look, attacking the United States, I understand, was a counterproductive, didn't achieve our goals. Let's go back just to directly trying to overthrow the Saudi royal family or the Egyptian regime of Mubarak and focus on something that is more doable. But instead, he continues to see the United States as the main enemy. And, you know, he's an intelligent guy. He went to a leading high school in Saudi Arabia. He studied economics at university, at a very good university in Saudi Arabia. But being intelligent doesn't necessarily mean that you're wise. And, you know, the tactics have taken over his strategy. His strategy has no chance of succeeding. And all he can do is sort of lash out in acts of violence. And increasingly, those acts of violence are less and less effective in terms of even just casualties. And I think around the Muslim world, there's a dawning recognition that the ideological virus that spawned the 9/11 attacks has also come back to kill Muslim civilians in countries from Indonesia to Morocco to Iraq to Jordan to Saudi Arabia. And this bin Laden is regarded as much less of a hero than he was in the immediate aftermath of 9/11.
So does it matter that to date the United States has neither been able to kill Osama bin Laden or to capture him?
I think it does matter. I mean, I think, you know, Al-Qaeda, when you join Al-Qaeda, you don't join Al-Qaeda by swearing an oath of allegiance to Al-Qaeda. You swear a personal oath of allegiance to bin Laden. And when groups like Al-Shabaab, which is the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Somalia, which a number of guys from Minneapolis and other American cities have joined, when these groups join Al-Qaeda, they don't say we're joining Al-Qaeda. They pledge a personal oath of allegiance to bin Laden. And so if you take him out of the picture, there's no real obvious replacement. He does have a number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, the Egyptian surgeon. But this is a guy who is not going to be – he's got – bin Laden has got this enormous stature in the jihadi movement. And Ayman al-Zawahiri just is not an adequate substitute. So taking him out of the picture, I think, would be quite important.
We're almost at our midpoint in this part of Focus. And again, our guest is Peter Bergen. He is the National Security Analyst for CNN. He is the author of the books Holy War Incorporated, The Osama Bin Laden I Know. His new book is The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda, published by the Free Press. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and New York University's Center on Law and Security. And he's also written for a number of publications, including New York Times, Washington Post, The Atlantic, Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs. Questions are welcome. We have one person ready to go here, and others can call in. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Champaign County, line one. Hello?
Hi. Yeah, I have a broader question about the Afghan war and the Northern Alliance warlord strategy of the Bush administration and now the continuing use of that, plus the military contractors who number more than the troops, apparently. But I've heard you before, and you've explicitly said that this sort of naive idea that you asserted earlier that bin Laden had that after this attack, the will to stay in the Middle East would entirely collapse on the U.S.'s part. I haven't heard you say why you believe that. It seems really, I'm skeptical that he could actually believe that. And you said he was an educated man, and had been already in the trenches in various parts, you know, offering his minions in the early days, and then even in the Bosnian War, there was some use of jihadists in that time. You know, why do you believe that he thought that the entire military and edifice and the biggest prize in the world in the Middle East, the oil, would be left unattended just after one attack? I mean, when I say it again, it just sounds very, very dubious.
Well, I think you've answered your own question. I mean,
no, I haven't, because I still have it.
Well, okay. Well, let me just try and finish. I mean, I would. There are any number of interviews where bin Laden made this point, which you can just Google right now. The CNN interview that I produced in '97, John Miller's interview, ABC News in '98, an interview with Time magazine in 99 with Rahimullah Yousafzai, in which bin Laden made the point that he believed the United States was very similar to the former Soviet Union. It was weak. One blow, maybe two, it would pull out of the Middle East. It was exceptionally naive. Being intelligent doesn't mean that you're right. He just had this spectacularly misinformed view of what the United States was. He's only visited the United States once for a two-week visit in the late 70s. He's surrounded by himself with a group of yes men who sort of hang on his every word. And he made a big mistake. The history is replete with errors of relatively intelligent people who make big mistakes. Just think about the Japanese high command attacking the United States on Pearl Harbor, a tactical success but a strategic disaster for Japan. Or think about Hitler attacking the Soviet Union in 1941, which basically destroyed his regime.
I don't equate those, but it seems to me that those interviews are probably just braggadocio, and that I don't think that in this consoles with his fellow thugs that he would have actually believed that. One doesn't always say what one means. One diminishes one's opponent, but it's also a taunt, and it's also, I mean, obviously the theory that you're going against is the idea that he wanted to escalate the war on terror, and he wanted to involve the U.S. on the ground in Muslim states, that's what he probably really was thinking of. It. This wasn't in any way, at least I can't imagine it. Well, the broader thing that I was going to ask about was this warlord strategy of the Bush administration. Maybe it was because they were already looking ahead to Iraq, because obviously they were already talking about attacking Iraq in the first conclave that the first Treasury Secretary O'Neill went to. So they were going to do the Afghan strategy on the cheap. And just use the thugs in the Northern Alliance, the warlords that were still, paying off in a variety of ways. This seems to be a fatal flaw in the whole thing. You can blame Karzai for concerning with warlords, but the U.S. is paying off more of them than he is in some ways. And now we have this contractor strategy that the only way that the U.S. is going to be able to pull troops out is by probably escalating the contractor mess. And we see what kind of things happen with them in various places, in Iraq, and then this shooting in Pakistan that apparently was more likely a Blackwater guy than some kind of foreign policy, a State Department official, because he wouldn't have been traveling alone. Anyway, thanks a lot.
All right, Mr. Bergen.
I want to go back to the earlier point because I think it's very important. There is a kind of view that al-Qaeda, in a sort of post facto justification of the 9/11 attacks, about 4 years afterwards, started saying, hey, attacking the United States on 9/11 was all part of our diabolically fiendish and brilliant plan to pull the United States into the Middle East and bleed them dry there. Well, that was only years after the event, and it wasn't just bin Laden's public statements about his strategy that I use in this book and also my previous book. We have a lot of information now from al-Qaeda's documents that have been recovered and from al-Qaeda insiders, and they understood that bin Laden was attacking the United States because he really genuinely believed that by doing this, the authoritarian regimes in the Middle East would fall. Just as once the collapse of the Soviet Union brought about the collapse of its client regimes in Eastern Europe. So I would just, if you have an interest in this subject, I would urge you to read my book, and it's very well heavily annotated, so you can see the original sourcing. And for bin Laden, this, of course, backfired spectacularly. On the question of the Northern Alliance has largely been subsumed in the Afghan army, which is now our exit strategy from Afghanistan. And the Afghan army right now is not especially capable, but given the fact that President Obama has now said we'll be in Afghanistan until December 2014, that gives the Afghan army about 4 years to really build up its strength. And at the end of the day, the only way we can get out of there is with an effective Afghan army. As to the contractors, President Karzai shares some of the callers' skepticism about the contractors and has been calling recently to get the numbers of contractors down And I think that's the right thing at the end of the day. Over the time, the number of contractors doing things should decline as the Afghans step up.
Well, just and not to continue to belabor too much this point of bin Laden and what it was that he thought was going to happen and wanted to happen, at least it seems that our invasion of Iraq helped him make his case for the U.S. having an imperialist agenda in the region. It certainly got rid of someone he bitterly opposed, Saddam Hussein. It drew people into the fight against the United States. So you would have to say all of that, in a way, worked in his favor. At least he would not have been unhappy to see all those things happen.
Oh, yeah, I think he was very happy. And in fact, we have multiple statements for him celebrating the success of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And after al-Qaeda in Iraq suffered a strategic defeat there due to its own stupidities, bin Laden has been pretty silent on the subject of Iraq. But he couldn't have predicted by attacking us on 9/11 that we would be sufficiently incompetent that we would then attack Iraq, which, as you said, was Saddam Hussein was his long-term enemy. We did kind of precisely what bin Laden was hoping, which was overthrow Saddam. And at one point, al-Qaeda in Iraq controlled about a third of Iraq's territory. And I outline in the book how their tactical failures in Iraq led to their strategic defeat. And it was sort of an assisted suicide because the United States understood that al-Qaeda in Iraq had a number of vulnerabilities, allied itself with other Sunni groups who started attacking al-Qaeda in Iraq, and exploited that situation pretty deftly towards the 2007 time period.
We have some other callers here. We'll go to next someone in Decatur, line two. Hello.
Yes, yeah, I agree with most of what you say, but there's one other thing that you might, or one other aspect worth looking at, and that is bin Laden's observation of the Russian defeat in Afghanistan. And if he were to think, okay, if we could suck America into Afghanistan, he might bleed us or begin to bleed us dry. And I think if you look at it like he would have at least looked at that situation and said that's a possibility. If he had planned to do that, you got to admit he's going to be very successful because he's accelerated the demise of this country by bleeding our treasury in two wars. We're going to go off the cliff here economically fairly soon. So I'll listen to what you have to say about my comments.
All right.
I would say there's no evidence that bin Laden believed that we would invade Afghanistan in the way that the Soviets did. And in fact, we didn't anyway. When we invaded Afghanistan initially, there were only 350 U.S. Special Forces and CIA personnel on the ground. We allied with the Northern Alliance. It was a huge success. Tens of thousands of local soldiers overthrew the Taliban. It was not a success at the Battle of Tora Bora, where bin Laden disappeared. But for the beginning of the war, it was a success. Bin Laden didn't anticipate any of this. What he anticipated was that we might lob some cruise missiles in his direction or launch some airstrikes. He evacuated his training camps, but he didn't prepare for an invasion of the country and the overthrow of the Taliban. And why would he? It wouldn't make any sense that, let's draw the United States into this so that my Taliban protectors are overthrown. Doesn't make any sense on the face of it. On the question of is bin Laden bleeding us dry with his strategy, certainly he'd like to believe that. But he's, despite the fact that he studied economics at university, he's not a particularly good economist because at the height of the Vietnam War, we spent 9.5% of GDP on Vietnam in 1968 on our defense budget. Right now, we're spending 4.5% roughly on our defense budget and only 1% of our GDP in Afghanistan. We're spending $100 billion plus. It's a lot of money. But the United States is an enormous economy, and we can afford this. Clearly, there will be drawdowns of troops over the next several years. That money will start, the amount of money we spend there will start contracting. And the president has made a decision, which I think is the right one, to resource his strategy in Afghanistan properly and to make sure the Taliban doesn't come back.
I'd like to have you talk for a moment or two about the Battle of Tora Bora, since it's something that you write about it at some length in the book. Was the failure there to capture or kill bin Laden, was that bad luck or was that bad strategy?
I think it was both. I mean, I reconstruct the Battle of Tora Bora with accounts from the CIA personnel on the ground, Special Forces personnel on the ground, Afghan warlords who are part of the battle, accounts of al-Qaeda members who are there, either in Arabic language newspapers or in detainee interviews at Guantanamo, and also, you know, Bin Laden himself has described what happened there. And what is, and also, by the way, you can see, anybody listening to this can go to the U.S. Special Forces official history of the battle. One of the really interesting things that official history says is that between December 9th and 14th, there was multiple sources of information that Bin Laden was at Tora Bora, coming from all sorts of intelligence. The Bush administration, when they were fighting a close election with John Kerry in 2004, essentially pretended that they didn't know that Bin Laden was there, because this was a fairly effective wedge issue that John Kerry had. And they either were misinformed or they lied about this. I think that anybody who reads the book can see that it was well known in the upper reaches of the Bush administration that Bin Laden was at the Battle of Tora Bora. But right in the middle of the Battle of Tora Bora, Donald Rumsfeld instructed General Tommy Franks, the overall commander of the battle, to rewrite the Iraq War Plan, which was at that time 800 pages, and rewrite it in a week. And as Franks mentions in his autobiography, they were already working 7 days a week, 16-hour days, and then they were being asked to rewrite the Iraq War Plan. And so the ball was dropped and Bin Laden escaped. That was despite the fact that people on the ground were requesting more troops. Could more troops have stopped Bin Laden? We'll never know, because the experiment was never conducted.
Other callers next. Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Interesting conversation. I was curious about how you feel about President Obama's policy to not look too deeply into Bush administration, I would call them crimes, others might call them improprieties. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's a fact that there's quite a lot of continuity between the Bush administration and the Obama administration on kind of policies in this war against al-Qaeda. The big differences between the Bush first term and the Bush second term, many of the kind of counterproductive, I think, extra legal kind of approaches that the Bush administration took in the first term were struck down by the Supreme Court, were stopped by the CIA, and so there's the continuity between Bush 2 and the Obama term is pretty strong, whether that's not being able to close Guantanamo, whether that's amping up the Afghan war effort very dramatically, amping up the secret CIA drone campaign in Pakistan very dramatically. I think a number of people who voted for Obama probably didn't necessarily realize that he was really going to be serious about Afghanistan, probably didn't count on him to dramatically amp up the drone campaign in Pakistan, engage in help to the Yemeni government. And I mean, so there's some kind of continuity between these two administrations, policies, personnel, in the counterterrorism arena. I think if you sit in the Oval Office and you look at these questions, oftentimes they look pretty similar. It doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democratic. You're charged with the safety of the American people, and you're going to make certain decisions based on that charge. That's your most important obligation. And so, why hasn't Obama, called for some kind of commission to investigate the Bush era policies? I think he's got much bigger fish to fry, and decided that was not a fight worth having.
I want to thank the caller. We just have about 10 minutes left. I have several other callers. Let me just ask really quickly. The administration has said that troop withdrawal from Afghanistan will begin this year. They've also said that we should expect to have some forces there at least through the year 2014. What do you think about that, and do you think, in fact, there'll be American troops there longer than that?
I think there will be American troops in Afghanistan longer than 2014, because we will do some sort of status of forces agreement with the Afghan government, which allows us to stay there in some fashion. And we have an interest in Afghanistan's stability, and a lot of people in the Afghan government don't want us to leave. A lot of Afghan population don't want us to leave. In the book, I detail a lot of the discussions in the Obama National Security Council about what to do in Afghanistan. The book ends before this decision to stay till December 2014. I think this is a huge shift, kind of an underreported shift in the Obama administration's foreign policy, and the right thing to do, because I was in Afghanistan in December. A lot of Afghans were quite concerned that we would be suddenly precipitously leaving. You mentioned the drawdown this year. I think it's going to be relatively token. I don't see substantial troop reductions this year.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Peter Bergen. He is CNN national security analyst. His new book is The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. Other calls, Belgium, the community, next, line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to come to some kind of understanding here. It's interesting in that you look at the way bin Laden has started this situation that we're still dealing with, in that he wouldn't list, he had nobody around him to comment on the wisdom of his ideas. Now we look at Bush 43 and the problems ever since. Bush 43 obviously had a lot of input from lots of different directions, and he refused to listen but to just a few, and led us into problems we have today, in that now there's so much dissidence between each other in the United States. It seems though this whole problem is a cultural difference, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think the caller is correct to say that I think we still have a lot to find out about President Bush's decision to go to war in Iraq. We have his account in Decision Points, his new memoir, which I think glosses over. It's still, you know, he made the decision very much, I think, by himself. He famously said that to Bob Woodward that he didn't even consult his own father on the subject. And, you know, I think it was done for a lot of different reasons. But I don't think we've totally sorted out what those reasons were, what was the most important. In the book, I quote Doug Fife, who was the number three person in the Defense Department, as saying that there was a kind of a view of that there would be some kind of demonstration effect by the attack on Iraq. Anybody trying to attack the United States or even remotely threatening it would be attacked themselves. That was the kind of way that people saw things.
Well, it's
inside the Bush.
It does seem to be the case, though, that I think the one reason this is sort of confusing is that over time the Bush administration gave a number of different reasons for it. Invading Iraq. But I think it is also correct to say, I think you would say that of those stated reasons, of the things the Bush administration thought would follow, would be the result, none of them were accomplished.
Sure. If you look at the war aims and the rationales for the war, WMD, obviously there was no WMD. Connections to Al-Qaeda, there were no connections to Al-Qaeda. The war would pay for itself. It turned out to be more than $1 trillion. We'd be greeted with flowers instead we were greeted with IEDs. Al-Qaeda was in Iraq, and we actually succeeded in implanting Al-Qaeda in Iraq. I mean, the list goes on and on. So historians will be looking back on this decision for many years. Was this the worst, presidential foreign policy decision in decades? I think there's a fairly good argument to say that it was. Mm. And, of course, it shortchanged Afghanistan. Iraq received five times more funding than Afghanistan for many of the first years of the war. It received the best counterterrorism intelligence resources. It consumed all the presidential attention. I quote David Kilcullen, General Petraeus' counterinsurgency advisor in the book, who says that until 07, the end of 07, the Bush administration was all Iraq all the time. They just could not focus on anything else. It was only in the sort of late 07, early 08 time period that they began to refocus on Afghanistan, began to realize that things were not going well. Some of General Douglas Lute, who is now Obama's Afghan key person on the NSC, National Security Council, he was also there under Bush. He started going to Afghanistan, realizing things were not going right. And very belatedly, the Bush administration started thinking about how do you fix Afghanistan.
Other callers. Champagne is next. Line number one. Hello. Yes.
Hi. Good morning. I started listening a little bit too late. I didn't call the name of your guest this morning, but his statements were so inaccurate that I wanted to ask a couple of things. First of all, Al-Qaeda never, ever have been in Iraq. By religion and by ethnicity and tribes, they're different. Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden people than Iraq, Saddam ever never allowed them to be in Iraq. That's first. That's another lie by this gentleman today. But also, during 9/11, Al-Qaeda never was involved. Saudi Arabia was involved in 9/11. Needless to say, the new book from David Palmer, The Ground Truth, the story behind America's defense of 9/11, who was a senior counsel of 9/11 Commission, he admits in the book that their commission foundings were based on government lies, etc.
I think we can fairly quickly give you the opportunity to deal with both of those things. At least I expect, I think I know what you would say.
I think the caller misunderstood me on the first point. I was saying that there was no evidence of Al-Qaeda in Iraq until we invaded Iraq. And then Al-Qaeda opportunistically came into Iraq. And in fact, one of the documents I quote in the book was a document from Saddam Hussein's Mukhabarat, the intelligence service, in which they were putting out an all-points bulletin looking for Abu Musab al-Zarqawi at the beginning of the war. So rather than being allied with him, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, they were actually looking for him. On the question of bin Laden or Al-Qaeda's involvement in 9/11, you know, there will always be conspiracy theorists on any major act of any major historical event. But, you know, just consult what bin Laden himself has said about the attack. I'll give you an example. 2004, bin Laden actually talked about how he was in – he instructed Mohammed Atta, the lead pilot, the lead hijacker, you know, to kind of do the attack in a certain way. And we have Al-Qaeda's videotapes of the 19 hijackers in which they all explain what they were doing. And these tapes have been widely disseminated around the world. So it's not just the investigation of the U.S. government. Al-Qaeda itself on multiple occasions has taken credit for the attacks for the very good reason that they did them.
All very short on time. I want to get at least one more call. This is someone also in Champaign. It's line two. Hello.
Hello. Quick question about Jason Burke. The best book I'd seen on Al-Qaeda was his, and then he wrote the thing about Kandahar after that. Do you differ with him in your understanding of Al-Qaeda? Do you find contradictions between what you've uncovered and what he's doing?
Jason Burke is a friend of mine, and his book on Al-Qaeda was terrific. I think where we differ is Jason, who was writing in 2003, would sort of make the point that Al-Qaeda wasn't particularly well organized and was sort of a small group. And we've had a lot more information since, and Al-Qaeda's internal documents have been recovered in Afghanistan, many of them been translated. And rather than a small kind of disorganized group, which I think he portrayed it at the time, I think we now understand that Al-Qaeda was arguably the most organized terrorist group in history. It was immensely bureaucratic, like a lot of other murderous organizations. It had a very elaborate discussion in its bylaws of everything from furniture allowances for its members to vacation schedules for its members, salaries it would pay people, including extra salaries it would pay people for more than one wife, etc. So I think if we differed, it was on that. But, you know, Jason is a great journalist and somebody I admire a great deal.
In his more recent material, the stuff that's appeared in The Guardian and so forth, you find a general consensus of views between the two of you?
Yeah, I would say so. I think Jason is writing, my understanding is he has going to have a book coming out on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and it'll be very interesting to see what he has to say. You know, anybody who puts the amount of time into Afghanistan and Pakistan on the ground, as Jason has done, is somebody I admire. We may differ slightly on some of the specifics, but you know, he's done the real work.
We're just at the point we have to finish. I want to thank the caller and just ask you very quickly, Mr. Bergen, is Al-Qaeda still a threat to the United States?
Not a national security problem. I think it's a sort of second-order threat. You know, on Christmas Day 2009, if Northwest Flight 253 had blown up over Detroit, that would have been a big deal for global aviation, tourism, international business, and Americans' feeling of personal security. Luckily, it didn't blow up. But it wouldn't have been a 9/11 style event. So that's kind of the outer ceiling of their abilities right now. They continue trying to get small, lower-level attacks off in the United States. They will get one through probably eventually by the law of averages. Might kill dozens of people individually, you know, obviously a tragedy, but not 9/11.
All right. Our guest, Peter Bergen, is CNN's national security analyst. His new book is The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. It's published by the Free Press. Mr. Bergen, thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks also to Mike Jones, the engineer there at the other end of our connection at the New America Foundation.